say I'm a female founder, finding a, starting a fertility tech company, you know, if all of those ingredients are missing, like there are no female partners, they haven't backed female startups, or they're not investing in initiatives that support diversity, I think there is potentially some risk, maybe not, but potentially some risk that, you know, the partners might not have empathy towards your idea. They might not understand it. That said, I would say that I think a lot of investors are making strides here and are focusing more on incubating strong female talent, both in their portfolio companies that they invest in and on talent that they bring on board.
Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Fred Obiero.
Hello and welcome to the Ivy Podcast. My guest today is Rosie Chopra. She is the COO and co-founder of Magical. I'm super excited to have you with us today, Rosie.
Awesome. Yeah, it's really great to be here, Fred. Thanks for inviting me.
Rosie, could you please run us through your personal journey from working in strategy at various organizations to where you are currently as a co-founder of a startup?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, let's go all the way back to the beginning. I was born and raised in Toronto, Canada. And like most, my journey doesn't really start with what I ended up doing. I went to school for accounting. And it wasn't until I completed my master's of accounting, I was working at a public accounting firm, that I realized I was really in the wrong field. I was working, you know, all the time. I didn't like going into work every day. I dread it, frankly. And so I started doing some soul searching on what I was interested in. And I remember in college, I had actually taken a few strategy courses in my undergrad and in my master's year, and I'd really enjoyed them. So I decided to reach back out to my old prof, connect with people in my network that were working in management consulting and in corporate strategy positions at some Fortune 500 companies. And I decided to make the jump. So I ended up landing a gig at GE Canada as a strategy consultant. I spent a couple of years there working on their electric vehicle strategy, their lighting strategy. And it was through this experience I actually realized I really liked the work I was doing, but I wanted more of it. And, you know, again, just through tapping into my network and talking to people, I realized that management consulting would actually be a great lead pad for me to get more exposure to this sort of work. And I was fortunate enough, you know, to land a job at Deloitte Consulting. And Deloitte was an awesome experience. I really got to spread my wings. I worked on a number of different initiatives and projects. And I was there for about 3 years, you know, joined as a management consultant, left as sort of like an engagement manager. And, you know, what I took away most from that experience was sort of structured thinking, problem solving, and communication skills. And so, you know, in the background of my Deloitte experience, I had absolutely no plans to leave. But my then boyfriend and now husband had actually founded his own software company in the HR tech space, and he'd been working at it for 5 years. And I was helping him out on the side in between projects at Deloitte. And then in 2015, he started talking to the folks over at LinkedIn, and they said that they wanted to acquire his company. And he said yes. And so we were already planning on getting married. And so, you know, we kind of moved up the timeline a little bit. And literally 2 days after the wedding, we moved to Silicon Valley because his company had been acquired and they wanted him out there. And so, you know, at this point, I decided to leave Deloitte and take a few months off. I actually physically couldn't have even worked in the US because I didn't have a visa to work. But it was nice. It was actually the first time in my career I had taken a break. So I had a couple of months off. And, you know, during that time, I was figuring out my next play, like, what do I do next? And, you know, in the background, we were living in Mountain View, which is like, you know, where the headquarters of like Google is. And you're surrounded by all the tech companies. Our networks soon became a lot of tech people. And I just got really interested in it. And I thought, like, well, I'm here. I definitely want to join a tech company. And so I was interviewing at a few companies. But Atlassian really caught my attention. Atlassian is like a global software as a service giant. And, you know, at the time, it was really branded as the company with no sales force, like the company that's actually profitable and cash flow positive, which is You know, you run a tech company, Fred, but that's like kind of like the antithesis of tech. And so it caught my attention and I really liked it. I liked the people there. I loved the business model. And so I joined Atlassian and was there for roughly 4 years on the strategy and BizOps team. I grew first as a manager on that team and then ended up running the team as head of strategy and BizOps near the end of my term. And yeah, it was a really cool experience. It was sort of like this, you know, defining point in my career, you know, working at this company that was $300 million in revenue when I joined. And when I left, it was close to $2 billion in revenue. I got super immersed into sort of like this product-led growth engine. And it was just fascinating to work on so many interesting projects with such smart people. So that brings me to, you know, your original question, like how did I transition from this career and strategy to co-founding a company? And that's a really interesting one. And I don't think it would have happened if it wasn't for COVID. So like many people, COVID just completely disrupted everything in my life. We lost childcare. I have a two-year-old at home. We had a bit of a personal emergency come up, among other things. And so I decided to leave Atlassian, took some time off of work. And at that time, my husband was working on his next startup idea. And it was a productivity play. And the goal was this company, for this company to be, you know, bottoms up SaaS. So like no Salesforce, very similar to the Atlassian model, and very much in my wheelhouse. And so I started spending evenings helping him out with brainstorming. And I just got really immersed in the idea and was just really excited and compelled by it. And so it became a very natural decision for us then to work together. And so, yeah, we've been working together for the past 8 months. It's been like a blast. And by the way, if you're interested in checking out our app, I know you mentioned at the beginning, Fred, but our website is getmagical.com. I'm actually surprised we were able to get that domain. And we're a productivity tool that's focused on helping people automate mundane work. And so, yeah, check us out. But it was a bit of a nebulous path to kind of get there, as most career journeys are. But I've been really, really stoked and excited by this opportunity.
Thanks a lot for that very detailed background and overview. I have a quick follow-up for what you just said. So your new startup is automating mundane work. Is that more like a robotics plus automation?
Yeah, exactly. So what we're trying to do essentially is a bottoms-up robotic process automation play. And so when you think about traditional RPA tools, they're very tops-down sales-driven. They usually take months, if not longer, to actually implement, require IT involvement. And so even when we were talking to companies, when we were ideating on this sort of problem space, what we were hearing is RPA is awesome, but it's just, you know, something that as an organization takes so much lift. And what we were finding was what leaders really wanted was to empower their own teams to be able to automate their own processes. They know best. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what we're trying to do.
Wonderful. So let's talk about your transition from corporate environment to a startup. Could you please share with us any practical recommendations on how to succeed through such a transition? You know, what are some of the lessons learned and what do you wish you knew ahead of time?
Yeah, awesome. I think there are, you know, a lot of the things that kind of come top of mind are fairly common things that you would hear, but maybe I'll put my own spin on it. So there's a few that come to mind. I think the first one is be prepared to roll up your sleeves. So I'm COO of our startup. I handle everything back office, finance, HR, legal. I also handle, you know, all of our product analytics, monetization, and now marketing as well.
So you wear a lot of hats.
Wear a lot of hats. And I think you have to, when you have a really small team, I think our team is no bigger than 10 people at this point. You have to. And, you know, you are dipping your toes into a number of functions, but I think, you know, this brings me to my second point. While you need to be prepared to roll up your sleeves, make sure you do outsource what isn't meaningful to you. So know your own value, call the shots on what you need to get stuff off your plate that doesn't fit with your core competencies, or that just isn't really worth your time. So for example, bookkeeping, taxes, that's stuff that I'm just not gonna do. It's not worth my time. There's other things that are a lot more interesting, like our content strategy, but we've been able to hire awesome people that really, really know how to do this, you know, are contracting out for us, that have picked that up. I think the other learning has been ditching structure. So, you know, the things that work really well in big companies, like even simple things like having a one-on-one or like scheduled one-on-ones. Those are hard to complete when you're this early on. And generally speaking, give us a team of 10 people, you're probably catching up any day, every day anyway. Right, so right. You don't really need a one-on-one per se. So I think ditching structure is really important. Find your peeps, find your community. So I'd say that like, you know, this is actually like even in a corporate environment, you'd want to find your network. It's just for me, I think what I realized is my network has evolved now to people that are in the same stage and kind of going through what I'm going through. So, you know, you'll learn from them, you'll grow from them. Sometimes it's actually even just therapy to talk to them as well too. So I think that that's really important. You know, I think this is like a common one you'll hear, but I think it's, you know, come in with a just fix it mentality. I think this is something that you do at big companies as well, but generally I'd say the stakes aren't as high at big companies because if something goes wrong, there's usually enough infrastructure to support you and to kind of catch, you know, what's happening there. In a startup, like you need to be really keen on spotting the problem, prioritizing all the problems because there's going to be more than one, coming up with solutions and then, you know, picking the right solution and executing on it. And it's kind of like a rinse and repeat because there's always going to be fires. The product is never done. And then I think one of the last things is don't negate the importance of culture. So this is super critical. And I think this is something that we've really put a lot of emphasis on, especially in light of the year we've been through with COVID. But, you know, hiring really awesome people is hard. And we, you know, we made a decision that we want to hire the best people. And so we're willing, you know, to pay more for them. But the thing is that really awesome people will leave if they're unhappy. And so you want to make sure your workplace is one that you want to work in. So we really try hard to really focus on that element of things. I guess actually last thing I'll say is one thing maybe I wish I knew, because the rest of these things, I think I kind of knew, but when you're really like immersed into it, you really know. But one thing I kind of wish I knew was, again, just how much infrastructure exists at big companies, such that even like basic things, like, you know, we have someone going away on pat leave, like figuring out parental leave policies, or creating, you know, like our basic data model that we instrumented into Amplitude, like all that stuff falls on you. So I think that that's kind of like the exciting part of joining a startup is like you are really building from scratch.
And to that point, I was going to ask, are you more flexible when it comes to, you know, allowing people to like say, take time off versus in a bigger organization where you'd have to like put in a request ahead of time, maybe wait until you get that approval? You know, do you like that aspect of a startup where there's more flexibility?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's like, so in some ways it's like more flexibility, in other ways it's like less. Like it's, you know, if I was at a big company, like taking vacation for like a week or two, you know, seems like a no-brainer. Like it's kind of like part of the package of why you join a big company. Yeah. And then at a startup, it's like, you know, I can't even think about certain things like that. Like I will, right, obviously time off when I need to, but it's like there's always so much to do and I'm so passionate and fired up about it that it's like, you know, I don't want to, but yeah, I do agree that, you know, generally speaking, I'd say that, the lack of structure is kind of, it's heartening. Like it's really fun. And it makes, you know, it makes you question all the stuff that you did before with so much structure. And you're like, why did I do that way?
I can totally relate to that. So let's talk about the pandemic last year. Plenty of companies have had to rethink their strategies since the start of COVID-19 pandemic. And some of the strategies have become more important than others. For instance, remote workers and digital transformation. What are some of the recommendations that you can share with us on how companies can better prioritize newer strategies that were not on their radar prior to the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So this is like leveling from my experience at Atlassian, but I'd say that like, especially when it comes down to prioritization, it's almost like there's so many different roads to kind of achieve what your end destination is, whatever that end destination will be. So, you know, for some companies, it's like our overarching vision, like how do we actually get there? And there's multiple roads to get there. Or, you know, it could be even more concrete or specific, like what's our quantitative goal of where we want to be in a couple of years out. And so I'd say that this really ties into some of the work that I did at Atlassian, which was really around strategy planning. And so strategy planning and that whole process is like, generally it's like there's a long-term component of 3 to 5 years out, where do I want to be? And you can think of that as like vision, mission, your big, hairy, audacious goal, the strategies or the initiatives to kind of get there. And then how does that translate into an operating plan for the next year? So it's like if I were to start with the high level of where I want to go in 3 to 5 years time and then ladder that down into, okay, well, where do I want to go in the next year? What does that look like? And usually companies will employ different mechanisms. We use like the OKR methodology, objectives and key results. And so, you know, every team would have their own set of objectives and key results that ladder into our company sort of vision and mission. And then that goes into like some sort of financial budget or plan, because usually any of your goals are likely going to be people oriented. So if you're saying like, hey, I'm going to push the needle and grow X part of the business by 40% in revenue for this year or whatever it is, like that could be one of your concrete goals, then that's going to then translate into, okay, well, I need people because I'm going to be building out new features for the app or whatever it is. And so there's obviously a huge hiring component to any of these plans. And then beneath all of that, there's like, you know, enablers. And enablers are like things like your workforce strategy, your real estate strategy, et cetera. Because you can't, you know, now looking at all these linkages, how can you hire people if you don't know where you're going to be hiring them? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if they're going to be remote or coming to the office. Yeah, exactly. On site. And so the way I'd almost approach this question then, like now that I've kind of provided that backdrop, is almost in a little bit of an inverse as a result of the pandemic. So normally I'd start with like, what is the strategy, right? Like, where do we want to be long term? Here in this case, I'd flip it a little bit. I'd say, okay, well, let's start with the enablers first. So if we say that like workforce strategy and you're, you know, embedded in that, your real estate strategy are examples of enablers that would have now dramatically shifted as a result of COVID. Let's think through what our strategy is here and, you know, what's going to be critical to our success. So is it going to be on site? Is it going to be fully remote? Is it going to be partially remote? And I think a lot of companies have now started to, at least in the tech ecosystem, like put stakes in the ground of saying like, I think, you know, Facebook has now said like, we'll allow fully remote. Mm-hmm. And, you know, related to that then is, well, if we're going to allow folks to go fully remote or partially remote, what are the implications on your comp strategy? And again, that's super critical because that then ties back in, like as I mentioned, into things like funding your other initiatives. And so I'd almost start there, like figure out what your enablers now look like in light of COVID. And then, you know, the next stage of that would be laddering up into your longer term goals. So have any of the goals changed? And this is like, you know, you're 3 or 5 years out. Have any of those things shifted as a result of the COVID pandemic? In certain cases, maybe your goalpost has not shifted. In other cases, maybe it has wildly shifted because you were in an industry that was like deeply impacted. And then I think the third component then is like, because, you know, having lofty strategies and all that stuff is great, but like what it really comes down to is execution. Is how does that then translate into your operating goals for the next year? So, you know, if you've decided, as an example, we're going to support fully remote, we have an estimation of how much our workforce is going to go fully remote. We now can back into our financial plan and how everything is sort of impacted there. And now we know like how much money we have on the table to actually fund different product investments or, you know, other initiatives across the business. And we can now come up with firm goals for the next year based on that.
Thanks. And you've actually covered part of the question that I was going to have as a follow-up, which was how you guys responded to the shift in strategy last year while you were at Atlassian. So thanks for providing that comprehensive response. Now, I want to go back to something that you mentioned earlier during your intro, where you talked about you set it out in accounting, right? But looking at strategy as a career choice, what does it take for one to get into the strategy profession? And what are some of the skills that have proven to help those that work in strategy be great at how they operate?
Yeah, absolutely. So first, let's define what strategy is, because I feel like, at least in the tech ecosystem, it can be a little bit of a nebulous term, and every company kind of defines it a little bit differently. So for, I'd say product-led growth companies or bottoms-up SaaS companies, where you have like this big self-serve mechanism for your business. So, you know, maybe you're relying less on a sales force, at least initially, and more so on your product to kind of like enable your growth. And so as a result, you're, you know, having people come to your website and buy your product instead. I'd say that there's maybe four components. So again, this is leveraging my experience at Atlassian, but we split up the strategy and BizOps group into these sort of four parts. So one was monetization and pricing. So this is essentially like, what is our pricing strategy for our suite of products? What is the willingness to pay across each of our products? What are the feature gates and fences that we want to employ? What do those packages actually look like in terms of a good, better, best, or, you know, like a standard premium enterprise sort of lineup? That's one element. The other one would be performance management. So this is like looking at the business end to end from a funnel perspective. How are we doing as it relates to churn? How are we doing as it relate, you know, as it relates to like MRR or revenue growth? The third aspect is strategic planning, which we just kind of touched on in the previous question. So how do you go from like 3 to 5 years out, where do we want to be, to, you know, our operating plan for the current year, to our financial plan? And then I'd say the fourth component is like kind of the random strategic projects that just get kind of thrown on your desk. So it's like, it could be questions coming from a GM or a product leader or like a founder of like, hey, we're trying to like enter in this new market. Like, what are your thoughts on it? Can you go figure out if this is a good or bad idea? Like that's something that would, you know, commonly fall on the plate of a strategy team. So, you know, taking the lens of those four components then of like how I'm kind of defining the scope, I'd say that, you know, there's a set of soft skills and a set of hard skills that you'd want to look for to be, you know, successful in this sort of a role. What I typically would look for on the soft skills front is things like problem solving, you know, folks that have very structured thinking. So, you know, will they have, like I said, there's multiple ways to get to the end destination. Are they applying a framework that's well thought out to it? Strong communication skills, because again, a lot of this comes down to storytelling. How do you take your work and then craft a narrative around it for the rest of the business? That's, I think, 70% of the job. And then I'd say that the last piece is business partnering and collaboration. So especially at product-led growth companies, BizOps and strategy teams will partner with product leads and heads of product. And so you have to have, you know, that level of collaboration and influencing skills. In terms of technical and hard skills, then, I think there's really three components. You know, one is analytics. So I usually look for folks that like, you know some SQL or have worked with large data sets. Really just the ability to draw insights from them is really critical. The second piece would be financial modeling. It's just very natural when you're coming up with a business case or you're answering one of those big hairy questions that I brought up earlier, like what market should we enter into? Knowing your way around an Excel spreadsheet and knowing how to craft a financial model is really critical. And then the third component would be, and I know some folks disagree with me on this one, but I think customer research, especially at like smaller companies. So at Atlassian, the strategy team would engage in quant research, so quant studies, and then also qualitative research. Sometimes at other companies, you'll have your product marketing teams or even your product teams do work like that, or you might even have dedicated research teams. But I think, you know, again, going into like the data, like your internal data, is one component to finding the answer. The other component is actually like talking to your customers as well.
I want to ask you about startups. As a female co-founder of a startup, what are some of the barriers that entrepreneurs and startups normally face when it comes to obtaining funding?
Yeah, great question. So as a female, I didn't personally go through this, and perhaps I'm a bit of an anomaly. I have heard from female friends that they have faced some adversity when fundraising. And this is specifically from funds where there isn't any emphasis on diversity. So, you know, the quick checks, are there female partners at the firm? Are they backing female led startups? Are they in, you know, even if they haven't done any of that, are they investing in initiatives that show support for diversity? Like, those are some of the questions that should be top of mind. And I think, especially in cases of where, you know, your idea may be centered around a life experience that you're going through, which I think, you know, often the best ideas are, there is some risk that there might not be empathy or relatedness to your idea. You know, so an example here would be like, say I'm a female founder, or I could be a male founder, starting a fertility tech company. You know, if all of those ingredients are missing, like there are no female partners, they haven't backed female startups, or they're not investing in initiatives that support diversity, I think there is potentially some risk, maybe not, but potentially some risk that, you know, the partners might not have empathy towards your idea. They might not understand it. That said, I would say that I think a lot of investors are making strides here and are focusing more on incubating strong female talent, both in their portfolio companies that they invest in and on talent that they bring on board. I actually am spending a few hours a week currently with a VC firm called Inovia Capital. And they do actually, you know, I've seen it kind of firsthand. They do actively try to seek out female founders and are trying to invest dollars here. But yeah, just even, you know, kind of going back to the original question, I think even just doing those checks on the VC are really important as a female founder.
So what advice would you have for female founders that are, that may be going through, you know, funding rounds at different companies? You know, what is it that you will tell them that will help them obtain funding for their startup ideas?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, one of the things that we did when we were fundraising, and this is also because we really do care about diversity at our startup, and we've made it a goal to have 50% male to female ratio, or sorry, one-to-one field, male to female ratio, or, mm-hmm. or split between both. So we looked at VC firms that were diverse, where there were female partners, or, you know, we had that expectation that they backed female-led startups. We also sought out female angel investors. So even if our lead, you know, investors were not female, we did seek out female angel investors to invest in our startup. Do reference checks if you don't have a close relationship with the partner you're investing in. This is just in general too, regardless of whether you're female or male. I think that's, you know, really, really important. Talk to other startups that have taken money from that partner, you know, kind of understand what they're like in both the good times and the bad times. I'd say the other thing is, you know, you don't necessarily need to take the biggest check. You know, we really viewed taking money as a long-term partnership, and we wanted to make sure that the people who we were taking money from would be people we'd want to be by our side, you know, 10 years down the line. And I'd also say, you know, I kind of alluded to this earlier, but like, I'd also say, if you go down the fundraising path, you know, your angels do count as much as your lead investors. Like, take time to find people who can give you more than just money and brand. Like, I know it's sometimes exciting to say, oh, I got money from this person, but I'd say some of our best angel investors are the ones that have expertise in very bespoke areas and are actively working with our team and helping us fill in some of the gaps where they exist.
For people that are going through, you know, funding rounds for their startups, let's say it's their very first idea, they've never built anything like that, either for themselves or their fellow co-founders. How do they go about getting funding if they don't have that proven product that they can lean back on to say that, hey, I'm asking for your funds because look, I've built such and such in the past. How do they go about getting funding?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think if I understand your question, it's like, if is it referring to a first-time founder that mm-hmm. That is trying to get money but hasn't necessarily built something yet? Like, they have
Correct.
Maybe they're fundraising based on an idea.
Yeah, they're fundraising based off of an idea, and they don't have a track record of having built something similar in the past. They just have an idea and they want to get funding for it.
Yeah, so I'd say that's, to be completely honest, I think that's a little bit more challenging. And again, you have to think from a VC perspective of, you know, and even for yourself too, would you invest in that sort of a company that's just solely based on an idea? There's no track record of maybe the founder having either successfully built and sold a startup, or, you know, alternatively has a track record at a company where they build products. And so, like, I think either of those things are fairly table stakes in order to raise funding, especially if you're a first time. Well, I guess the first one would have implied that you would have been a second time founder, but I think having something built would almost be table stakes unless you have a track record at a company where, you know, you've had successes and wins. What I would suggest to a founder that has had neither, so meaning maybe you haven't, you know, built a product at a tech company or any other company for that matter, and you're kind of like just starting out from scratch, I'd say that you probably don't want to take funding initially. You probably want to build your actual product, prove out early product market fit, and then go off and fundraise. And that's actually, like, you know, better for you as well too, because you actually get to prove out the business model and see if it actually works. And I'd say that some of the best startups are the ones that are actually bootstrapped initially, because they have so much fight in them to actually figure out if their idea has legs or not. You know, even speaking to my husband's experience, he actually never took he actually never fundraised. He bootstrapped his entire first startup. And, you know, when it was time to fundraise, when he had actually proved out his market, he got acquired. So I think there is actually some really big benefit in kind of following that path as well.
Businesses are increasingly relying on data to create value and make well-informed decisions strategically. What are some of the data attributes that strategy teams analyze to ensure that their organizations are on the best strategic path to meet their set objectives?
Yeah. So at our startup Magical, and then in my past life at Atlassian, there's several frameworks that you can kind of use, but I think one that I really like that generally works for most software as a service companies and product-led growth companies is it's called the Pirate Framework. It's the AARRR framework. So when you actually spell out all those letters together, AARRR, it sounds like a pirate saying R. And so what it stands for though is acquisition, activation, referral, retention, and revenue. And I like this framework for, identifying what data to look at because it carves out your entire funnel essentially. So if you think about acquisition, how many people are landing on your page? How many people click trials? How many people eventually download your app? Like that's awesome. Like you kind of get those insights from that one bucket. Activation then is like, how do you get people to that aha moment? So, every great product has that singular moment of where you want your end user to actually get increasing amounts of value from your product. And so, activation could mean, if I was actually chatting with the founders of Loom the other day. Loom is like an app that lets you record your screen. But for them, activation essentially means the ability for a user to first, complete a video of their screen, share it to another user, and then have that user's video be viewed. So that's how they've defined activation as an example. The next one is referral. So referrals are, virality and baked into your products. You essentially, for most startups, the cost of acquiring customers can be exceptionally high. And so you want to reduce that as much as possible. And there's no better way than having in-baked virality mechanisms. Dropbox does this and does a wonderful job at this. You get a file. If you're not a Dropbox user, you click on that file and you automatically sign up. That's a really good example of in-baked virality. And so tracking your referral metrics. So how often does a user actually like click on the referral link, send it out, and how many installs do you get from referrals are easy metrics early on that you can kind of track. The fourth one is retention. So here you're just measuring your churn more or less. So this could be churn for paid users. If your app is completely free, it could be how many users are actually churning off even the free trial or the free version of your app. You could also look at dormancy here. So users that download your app but basically do absolutely nothing. That's something else you'd probably want to track in retention. And then the last one is revenue. Really straightforward, but how is your revenue? Whether you're measuring it as like monthly recurring revenue or if you just have regular sort of standalone revenue that's not subscription based, how is that growing month over month? That's something else that you want to track.
Great. And for a last question, this is for listeners. What helped you get to where you are today? And what advice would you give to someone that wants to pursue a career that's similar to yours?
Yeah, good question. So I think, a couple of things here. One would be trusting yourself. So if you find that you're in a job that you dislike, or you've just had enough, don't settle. It sounds really corny, but like listening to your inner voice, I think is really critical. I think early in my career, had I just stayed in accounting, I would have been miserable. And so that was like a non-option for me. So just really trusting yourself and just knowing that like you'll figure it out. I think the second is being really open to learning. So jumping on board to something might be scary at first, whether it's a new job, a new project, even working with a different leader. But you'll definitely learn something from this experience. So just even being open to that, I think is important. The third, which I actually didn't really realize until like, I think a little bit later in my career, but like really focusing on building your network, like find the people who do what you want to be doing or who you're interested in learning from, get to know them, ask them questions, learn from them. Don't underestimate the power of networking. The other one I'd say is, this is really important to me, but always lean into your values. I think the one thing that has not changed in my career journey is the core of who I am. And it makes it really easy to make decisions when something doesn't ladder up against my values. And yeah, lastly, I just say, don't risk regret, just do it. Like if you're having those lingering, like what ifs, like, oh, I've always wanted to start my company, but I'm just not sure. I just jump aboard and do it, because I feel like you can always make excuses like this isn't the right time, or like, you know, maybe I can just pause and do it a couple of years from now or whatever it is, but just jump on it and just do it. Worst case, it doesn't work out and you can always find something else to do afterwards.
Absolutely. Always take a shot. Don't be afraid. And you never know, you might end up with something that's really good and something that the society needs. Rosie, okay. Thanks a lot for being with us and sharing your insights with us. I will definitely be reaching out to you and trying to see how far your new startup goes.
Cool. Sounds great. Thanks so much, Fred.
Thanks.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Ivy Podcast. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.